Christopher Hitchens is a British journalist writing about American politics for such magazines as The Nation, The Spectator, and Harper's. His own political views are left of center, something he never hides from his editors or his readers. In fact, he criticizes the American press for having elevated objectivity to an ideology. Hitchens moved to the United States in 1980 when Victor Nevasky, editor of The Nation, invited him to write a column. His essays and columns from the past 8 years have been collected in a new book titled Prepared for the Worst. Hitchens writes that if this collection has a point, it is the desire of one individual to see the idea of confrontation kept alive. I asked Christopher Hitchens if he thought of himself as a confrontational journalist.
Yes, I do. Very much so. I think it's essential to bring ridicule to bear, to bring irony to bear, to bring satire to bear on the... Especially this has been true in the last 8 years, which the collection Prepare for the Worst implies by its name an attitude to. Time of tremendous lying and tremendous euphemism and tremendous dishonesty, and nobody really prepared to call things by their right names.
Well, you criticize the press for treating Reagan as a blooper merchant instead of as a habitual liar.
Well, that's right. No one would say that what he was doing was lying. It all had to be, oh, he misspoke, or he misstated himself, or the president appeared confused, when he was really trying to lie his way out of a tight corner. And whereas, you see, this also reflects on another thing I'm very much against, which is the standard of pseudo-objectivity taken by most of the press, whereby you mustn't be, another word I hate, judgmental. You mustn't editorialize. Now, see how this comes out. The phrase Ronald Reagan is a great communicator has appeared in every paper you've ever read as a fact, as a piece of news. They say, they go on about what a great communicator he is. Matter of fact, that is a value judgment. It's a matter of opinion. It is editorializing. It's judgmental. It's not a fact at all. Can't be weighed as a fact. The phrase Ronald Reagan is a liar has never appeared in any newspaper you read, though it is a factually verifiable statement. It would be nonetheless considered to be judgmental. If you see what I mean by that example, you'll see what I mean by the need for confrontation.
Well, the mainstream press prides itself on being objective. Do you think that there's a political view that's actually expressed by journalistic outlets that think of themselves as being objective?
I think objectivity is an ideology in itself. You cannot be objective unless you are literally mindless. If you have a mind, it will evolve a position. And the best thing to do is to state honestly what that is and submit it to the test of evidence and experience. But people here, I think, confuse objectivity with detachment, with impartiality, and with other apparently desirable things that are not really theoretically attainable. What they end up with is mere neutrality, mere indifference, which always, as it turns out, has a bias towards the status quo and the powers that be.
You have a piece that's very funny that you call Blabscam in your new collection, and it's about being on the Sunday morning talk shows and the shows of sparring political journalists arguing with each other and taking different positions on the issues of the day.
Or not doing so,
right. You say you were held back a little bit.
Well, yes, actually, that is one area where I think anyone with real opinions does suffer. I think the allegedly confrontational free-for-all TV shows that come out of Washington are utterly fraudulent. They're all designed to reinforce the existing consensus of opinion, which is predominantly a conservative one. And that this is done under the pretense, which is what annoys me, of being unscripted, two-fisted, into the ring and let's have it out. Particularly this is true of the McLaughlin Group, that sort of zoo program that quite a lot of people are now addicted to. Where, in fact, the whole thing is fixed completely in advance. Everyone knows what the question is going to be, in what order it's going to be asked of them.
You were briefed beforehand?
Absolutely, many times. I mean, it was a week of briefing before one went on the air. And the whole thing is designed, actually, to make sure that it comes out as another bit of consensus, strained through pseudo-objectivity.
You know, when I got your book, I skimmed the book jacket before actually reading the book. And on the book jacket, it said that there's an essay about how you discovered your Jewishness, and I thought that meant that you had gotten more in touch with your Jewish roots. Well, when I read the piece, I found out you actually discovered, for the first time, that your mother was Jewish, that her side of the family was Jewish. Can you tell us the story of how you found that out?
Yes, I can. I can sketch it for you. I mean, it was the family secret. My mother's family had emigrated from Central Europe at the end of the last century. And though they had, until my grandmother's time, remained religious and kept up the Jewish observances, they had changed their names. They'd anglicized their names. And in my mother's generation, I never talked about it with her because she died before I discovered this. A decision must really have been taken to assimilate. I mean, she married a British naval officer, my father, towards the end of the war. And I think, my speculation is, her ambition was for me to grow up as an English gentleman and not to know that there was this family secret. And she also kept it from my father, who I'm certain wouldn't have minded, but whose possibly elements of whose family might have been a little wary of having a Jewish woman marry in. But at any rate, it was the family secret, and I discovered it because my grandmother, my Jewish grandmother, outlived both my father and my mother.
Do you think of it as cowardly at all that your family covered up their Jewishness?
Not cowardly exactly, no. I mean, Britain has never been a country that persecutes the Jews, but it is a country where there's a lot of quiet, furtive prejudice and a certain amount of discrimination, and I think they thought, you know, without completely betraying our roots, you know, we can assimilate and get by this. And I think what makes people do that is their children. They don't want them to have to be discriminated against. And so what that means in this case is that I was the one who was supposed to be, you know, preserved from any discrimination. Well, the fact is, I would consider anyone who disliked Jews to be a personal enemy at any rate, and would hope to arouse their hostility or dislike, so I don't mind getting whatever's coming from that quarter.
You have been very critical toward Israel, and one of your editors said something very funny to you. She said, well, so you're Jewish, well, this will be good for you, because it's okay for Jews to criticize Israel. And that's actually a very funny thing to say, but I was wondering if you thought that you would end up somehow reconsidering any of your politics, or if you had to think about whether finding out that you were Jewish was cause for thinking about rethinking politics.
Well, I was actually rather annoyed when that editor said it to me, because it seemed, though I could see what she meant, it was in a way a slightly heartless remark. It isn't as if I can now say, well, okay, I'm allowed to criticize Israel, because that's sectarian. It'd be tribal to think like that. The Middle East is a very urgent subject of concern for anyone who thinks about or cares about politics. It has huge international implications. It involves everybody. It's going nuclear. It already involves huge questions of strategy. So I think anyone has a right to take an interest in it. And I think anyone who looks at it objectively, or tries to look at it objectively, will see that a huge injustice has been done to the Palestinians. And they'll see that whether they're Jewish or not. And many, many Jews, Israelis and diaspora Jews, have always recognized that. And at the moment, unfortunately, that view is not the predominant one.
Now, I think your revelation about, you know, Jewishness in your family brings up a really interesting question, and that is, how much does or how much should family history influence your own choices in life? And I mean, how much does it affect the way you decide to live your life, and how much does new information affect the course of your life?
Well, I mean, we are the things that our families make us, but I think education and culture can get us to the point where we realize, look, there is only one race, which is the human race. The fact that most people, let's face it, believe in Islam because they're born in Islamic countries. The same is true of most Catholics. They're Catholics, they're born into Catholic families. We've, in this century, reached a point where we can transcend that. We know there are alternatives, and we know that there are visions beyond the merely national or tribal or religious. I think we will never be able to overcome our family roots. And one doesn't want to be contemptuous of one's parents, but one ought to try, I think, and outgrow them. And by that, I mean intellectually as well. It's the best answer I can come up with, I think.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Anytime.
Christopher Hitchens' collection of essays, Prepared for the Worst, is published by Hill and Wang. This is Fresh Air.